Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Trucks from 1997. Adapted by Brian Taggart from a short story by Stephen King and directed by Chris Thompson. Although, to really get the full story behind this made-for-TV movie, we need to flip that 9 and 7, because the love affair between television and Stephen King adaptations really starts in 1979 with Tobe Hooper's primetime, big-budget miniseries version of the novel Salem's Lot. That wasn't the first ever adaptation of one of the celebrated horror author's works. He was already famous for Carrie, which had been adapted by Brian De Palma and which helped to propel him from obscurity to the ranks of stratospheric fame he still enjoys today. I know I personally read everything he wrote throughout the 1980s and on into the 90s up through Gerald's Game. But to get back to Salem's Lot, it was a huge hit for CBS, leading to a number of movie adaptations throughout the 1980s, including one directed by King himself, Maximum Overdrive, that was also an adaptation of his short story Trucks. But when ABC decided to adapt his novel It into another television miniseries due to that book's length and complexity, and that became a hit even more massive than Salem's Lot, it didn't take long before made-for-television King adaptations became practically an annual event. The short story Sometimes They Come Back was adapted in 1991, King's novel The Tommyknockers in 1993, The Stand in 1994, The Langoliers in 1995, and by 1997, King adaptations were seen as one of the safer bets for television events. And with King himself practically disowning Maximum Overdrive, the door was open for the USA Network to do a more faithful and serious version of the very creepy story he originally wrote for Cavalier magazine back in 1973. A brief aside, it may seem weird to modern audiences to imagine a taut, tensely written horror story appearing in Cavalier, which was basically just a pinup magazine featuring nude and scantily clad women. But back in the days when purchasing porn actually involved interacting with other human beings, it was useful to be able to pretend that you were actually buying the magazine for its thought-provoking literature and interesting interviews, and the presence of naked women was a mere fringe benefit. If you ever hear someone say, "Let me guess, you buy it for the articles," in regards to something salacious or risque, they're referencing this phenomenon. Taggart, an old hand at both horror and TV movies, he wrote the screenplays for Omen 4 The Awakening, the television version of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and V The Final Battle, as well as theatrical features Poltergeist 3, Of Unknown Origin, and Visiting Hours, was selected to flesh out King's original short story into a full-length movie. While Chris Thompson, a journeyman director from New Zealand with genre credits that included episodes of The Hitchhiker and Time Tracks, was selected to helm the production. And just to be clear, I don't mean journeyman in any kind of a pejorative sense. Directing television is hard, grueling work with tight schedules and small budgets, and knowing how to bring in a production on time with solidly executed visuals again and again is very impressive, even if he mostly just moved on from strength to strength without ever getting the kind of big projects that would make him a household name. Filming took place in Canada to take advantage of the same lucrative tax breaks that a lot of syndicated series of the period were using to get a little more bang for their buck. We've talked about this multiple times, but even though the most famous one was The X-Files, series like Highlander and Stargate SG-1 and Poltergeist The Legacy did much the same thing. That means that a lot of the cast is Canadian as well, because the tax credit requires using a certain percentage of Canadian actors, so it's time to play that old game, can you tell by looking at their IMDb credits whether they're Canadian or not? I'm workshopping the title, I promise. Playing Ray, our male lead, is Timothy Busfield, who is not Canadian. He's an actor, director, and producer that I'll admit I mainly know from his occasional use as an MST3K punchline. I think they just liked the way his name rolled off the tongue. But who most people would recognize from his 85-episode run on the series 30-something as Elliot Weston. Or possibly from the movie Revenge of the Nerds, where he played the original Poindexter. Yes, that's where that slang came from. He was also a regular on Trapper John M.D., The West Wing, and Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, as well as appearing in the movie Field of Dreams, and he's also directed a lot of television. He's very much in that John Ritter mold of actors with familiar faces and a vibe that always makes you happy to see them on screen, even if they didn't get A-list famous like Tom Cruise. Our female lead, Hope, is played by Brenda Bakke, also not Canadian. She's a character actor and day player who's popped up in a number of genre projects, including Death Spa, Under Siege 2, and Tales from the Crypt Presents Demon Knight, but I feel like depending on your level of cinematic snobbery, you're either going to know her from LA Confidential, where she played Lana Turner, or from Hot Shots Part Deux, where she plays Michelle Rodham Huddleston. Don't know what the Venn diagram is for those two movies, though. From here, things start getting a little Canadian. Brendan Fletcher, who plays Ray's son Logan, is an actor from British Columbia, who we've already seen as Mark in the 2003 film Freddy vs. Jason. He's Jason Ritter's supportive best friend who dies after learning that his big brother was killed by Freddy. But he's appeared in a ton of genre roles, and not just because he satisfies the Canadian cast requirements. He was in the old Goosebumps TV series, episodes of Millennium and Welcome to Paradox, and The Crow, Stairway to Heaven, and of course, Supernatural. He popped up in both the Ginger Snaps prequel and the Ginger Snaps sequel, albeit as different characters, and more recently he was in the movie Violent Night as Krampus. Violent Night was the Die Hard but with Santa movie, not the Killer Robot Santa movie that came out at about the same time. It's horror adjacent, but I don't necessarily know if it's ever going to be on this podcast. Ray's short order cook at the truck stop is George, played by Victor Cowie. He's from Winnipeg, but there aren't any real giveaways to that in his list of credits. Honestly, for the oldest member of the cast and thus presumably the most seasoned actor, he doesn't have a ton of credits to his name and none of them are especially recognizable. He seems to have been most active in the 90s, doing character roles in a number of films, and he passed away in 2004 at the age of 74. Believe it or not, there are still 7 significant cast members to go. I don't exactly think this film is overstuffed with characters, because they are all given something to do, even if it's just panic and make fatal mistakes, and you do definitely need a body count in a film like this, but I will say it makes following the different storylines a bit of a chore on first watch until everyone gets gathered up and isolated from the rest of the world, and we start seeing it as a directly ensemble piece. Now, most of these characters are the guests at Hope's alien-themed tourist attraction, Lunar Expeditions, starting with Thad, as played by Roman Pedora, and his estranged daughter, Abby, as played by Amy Stewart. They are both Canadian, with Pedora's CV giving us our first sightings of The Beachcombers and Danger Bay, and Stewart pinging the radar with Street Legal and Avonlea. For those of you who are new to this podcast, these are all long-running TV series for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, or CBC, which I remember from my own childhood because I spent my summers about 30 miles south of the Canadian border and the local CBC affiliate was the clearest signal our TV could get. But Pedora is one of those very familiar genre faces, a character actor who's been in everything from TV shows like Fringe and Supernatural and Mutant X, to genre flicks like the Assault on Precinct 13 remake and Final Destination 5, up to even a few small roles in Oscar winners like Chicago. Basically, he's one of those guys who just keeps popping up in an episode or two of everything we love, one of those hardworking day players who's never not hustling for the next job. I like that he gets a pretty meaty role here. And Stewart has also kept plugging away, albeit with fewer genre roles on her resume. She was in an episode of Due South and a couple episodes of Goosebumps, but she's for the most part stuck to regular dramas over the course of her lengthy career. Most recently, she had recurring roles on the shows Murdoch Mysteries, which is, I presume, about the infamous tabloid publisher solving crimes by illegally tapping people's phones, and Home Sweet Rome. Playing bickering married couple Brad and June, also guests of Hope's new resort, are Jonathan Barrett and Sharon Bager. Barrett has very few credits, although he does appear on an IMDb user list of Canadian actors, so I think we can assume he was there to help bolster the ranks of the Canadian cast, even though his sparse bio and credits as Greaser in Mob Story and Boyfriend in Heater don't shed much light on things. Well, Bager was born in Edmonton and has had a nice little career that includes Incident in a Ghostland and Orphan First Kill. She also served as intimacy coordinator on the set for that movie and several others, part of a welcome development for an industry that, as we've discussed in many other episodes of this podcast, hasn't always done the best job of making sure every actor feels comfortable doing an intimate scene. Cough, cough, Life Force and Return of the Living Dead, cough, cough. We also have Jay Brizzo playing what the script tells us is an old hippie named Jack in full defiance of our lying eyes. Brizzo is, you guessed it, Canadian, coming from Winnipeg, and brother does this guy have credits. He's been in the horror movies House of the Dead, They, Insomnia, Disturbing Behavior, Horns, and Antlers, which are somehow not related at all, as well as the 2009 big-budget Watchmen adaptation, he's the news vendor, the 1990 It adaptation, he's the taxi driver, episodes of genre TV from Supernatural and The X-Files to Highlander and Poltergeist The Legacy, episodes of all sorts of non-genre TV like Party of Five, voice credits from the original G.I. Joe all the way up to My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, and oh hey, what do we see here? A couple of shows called Danger Bay and the Beachcombers. This dude is the real deal. A full-package Canadian character actor who works hard and gets the job done, and I love him even though he is woefully miscast here. He looks like he should be playing taxi drivers and New York news vendors, not hippies. And oh my god, he was even in 4 episodes of Booker, a show so obscure I'm not sure even I've heard of it. And finally, we have Aidan Devine as Trucker Bob and Rick Skane as Trucker Pete, two characters who more or less serve as comic relief and expendable cannon fodder, although they're fed into the canon surprisingly late in the story. Devine is actually a British actor, so this one's kind of a trick question, and he's been in Transformers Rise of the Beasts, Suicide Squad, and Wolf Cop, alongside many other guest appearances and character roles. He was also a member of the cast of Veritas, The Quest, which is a genuine smorgasbord of genre character actors including Arnold Vosloo, Kobe Smulders, and Eric Balfour. Skeen, meanwhile, is another Manitoban who has some acting credits to his name, but is far better known as a stuntman and stunt coordinator. He worked in that capacity on Wishmaster 3 and 4, two movies I did not know existed until researching IMDb for this podcast, as well as The Haunting in Connecticut, Curse of Chucky, Incident in a Ghostland, We Summon the Darkness, and the 2019 remake of The Grudge. And he's still keeping busy. The upcoming horror film Clown in a Cornfield is one of his as well. You have to love seeing people who find their passion and get to live it for decades. And with that somewhat lengthy cast behind us, let's dive in. With the introduction of an entirely different character, although thankfully we're not going to spend a lot of time getting to know this one. We begin at a local junkyard, where the owner Phil, played by Harry Nelkin, feeds and waters his dogs Bingo and Star before going into his office to get a shower. He doesn't notice that one of his trucks has spontaneously repaired itself, the headlight popping back into the socket, until it shifts into gear and runs right through the building he's in, killing him in the process. And although I do like the way we get off to a nice early start on the killer truck mayhem, the original story started in Medias Res, so jumping in with a scene of TV-friendly carnage is a good way to flush things out while still sticking with the vicious and unrelenting tone of King's version, I will admit I'm bothered by the self-repair. It feels like the movie's breaking its own rules right at the beginning. There's a big difference between trucks that behave impossibly sentient and trucks that can just do anything because space magic. And I kinda wish they'd dropped this, even though I'll admit there's something nicely chilling about the way it's shot and staged. If you want a car that fixes itself, go remake Christine. We're about due, honestly. The car rolls out onto the entrance to the nearby stretch of road, and speaking of things I don't think quite work, the trucks in this movie tilt their side view mirrors a lot to take a look around them, and that's not impossible or anything, but it does look silly. It reminds me of when they have Daleks try to give significant glances in Doctor Who, only to discover that the big wide armature that the eyes are resting on makes everything look so broad and exaggerated as to be inadvertently comical. It's very cartoony, and I'm not a fan. Thankfully, it gets dropped pretty early on as we get into the violence of the second act and the trucks express themselves a little more directly. We then cut to a local truck stop, where a road sign informs us that we're just outside the small town of Lunar, Nevada, which I want to stress is spelled L-U-N-A-R, as in related to the moon, and not L-O-O-N-E-R, as in the colloquial term for people with a sexual fetish related to inflating and popping balloons. This is very important because the two words sound exactly alike, and thanks to the comedians at Riff Tracks, I now know about this particular fetish, and it really changes the meaning of a lot of the dialogue if you keep thinking they're talking about the latter and not the former. We are also told that Lunar is the last town before Area 51, so let's just pause for a moment and talk about why that's important and how it wound up in this movie. The extremely quick and dirty version is Area 51 is a U.S. military base in Nevada where they test experimental aircraft. The U-2 spy plane was developed there along with the first stealth fighters, along with several evaluations of captured Soviet aircraft, and although it exists in an environment of top secrecy, it's impossible to be truly secret when the things you build are flying in the skies around the base and binoculars and telescopes, exist. For decades, everyone in the region has known that there are weird things up there in the sky around Area 51 and the government isn't talking about it. And because this movie was made in the 1990s, and as we've said in the past, the 90s were the golden age of conspiracy theories thanks to the intoxicating reach and lack of any kind of moderation of the early internet, along with shows like The X-Files that traded in blurring the line between conspiracy theories and out-and-out fiction, and the rise of AM radio hosts like Art Bell, who was happy to use conspiracy theories to boost his own public profile right up until he wasn't, but that's a long sad story for another day. Anyone could put up a website talking about anything on the internet. Everyone could find their community, whether it was queer people or sci-fi fans or conspiracy theorists. And it hadn't yet become apparent to us all just how much of this stuff was rooted in racism and paranoia. It was fun, and it was harmless, and it made the world seem like a more interesting place. And because of that, when people saw strange flying objects over Nevada that seemed to defy the current conventional understanding of aircraft capabilities, and that the government refused to talk about, the natural conclusion was that this was where they were keeping all the alien artifacts we had of course found and were concealing from the general public. It became such an accepted cultural trope that by the end of the 90s, all you needed to do was mention Area 51, and everybody knew you were writing a story about aliens, government cover-ups, and futuristic technology being kept from the public. And even though that's not really what this story is about at all, and none of the Area 51 references will come to mean anything, it was just kind of obligatory to put them in. And it's certainly happy to use those ideas as a hook for the first act. Hope has just opened a resort next door to the truck stop, which is called Lunar Expeditions, and which blatantly caters to the conspiracy theory trade by offering backpacking tours of the countryside near Area 51, where guests are sure to see aliens and captured spaceships. Her van, confusingly enough, is labeled Lunar Express, which I guess does make a loose kind of sense because it's the pickup vehicle for Lunar Expeditions, but it makes me feel like she's about to hire Fry, Leela, and Bender to drive it. Yes, I know, that was Planet Express. Still brought up some odd associations. Hope's heading into town to pick up her first guests, who are arriving by bus, and she asks Ray and Logan to keep an eye out for two other guests who'll be driving in later that day. Ray's doing a little helicopter parenting of his teenage son, who, by the way, looks so much like a young Timothy Busfield that I want to give a special shout-out to casting director Alan Meyer for this instantly believable father-son relationship, but they both agree to keep their eyes open as Hope heads out to nearby Bridgeton to get her first tourists. She spots Phil's truck, now edging out into the road, and we then get kind of a lengthy sequence of info dumping that's a bit of a cautionary tale to aspiring screenwriters in a lot of ways. First, we get a little interaction between Hope, a truck driver played by Gene Pryors, and Lino, a young man who works at the local grocery store and who's played by Kirk Harper, in which we establish that this truck driver is racist and Lino is not an immigrant despite his Latino background. This sets up, mainly that the truck driver deserves to die because Lino's never going to be seen again in this movie, and there's really no other reason for this entire scene to exist. That's probably a minor sin on its own, but it's definitely a portent of things to come. Because when Tad, Abby, and Jack arrive, they all spill out their respective life stories in a lengthy sequence, only briefly interrupted by the murder truck action that's the ostensible point of the movie, and even that's kind of low-key and uninteresting. The refrigerated truck Gene Pryors is driving tricks him into getting into the freezer section in the back, then locks the door with the presumed intent of killing him through hypothermia. The backstories are as follows. Hope used to live in Lunar, but moved away for a long period before coming back in obviously troubled circumstances. Tad is an ex-military pilot who used to fly missions out of Area 51 and who knows there's no aliens there, but nonetheless really wants to go on an alien conspiracy-themed backpacking tour with his daughter. Abby is a rebellious wild child who hates her dad for splitting up with her mom and spending long periods of time away on business, and Jack is ostensibly an old hippie who gets saddled with agonizingly clunky lines like, "First time in this part of the cosmos. I mean it no harm." And don't get me wrong, I'm glad that some thought went into these characters' backstories, and one of the things that's genuinely nice about this movie is that it does function as an ensemble piece with very few characters that are there just to pad out the body count. But you don't have to spend the first act spraying a fire hose of exposition onto the audience, like in the very next scene where George tells Ray that it's been 2 years since his wife died and he moved from Detroit to Lunar with his son, and he's been overprotective ever since. So long as you know this stuff, and you include it when it's relevant and let it inform the character's actions even when it goes unsaid, you can have a much lighter touch than this film does. This info dump really does kind of set the wrong tone for the movie, especially as we've already had our first 1.5 truck kills. The driver in the freezer compartment is still alive at this point, technically, and we are ready to get to the action. Which does thankfully happen, after a bit more digression between Thad and Jack over their differing backgrounds in the military and peacenik movements, and an info dump from Hope about the town's many UFO sightings over the years, which is never really picked up as a thread despite getting a lot of play in the first act and even just the setting of the film. The original story had nothing to do with Area 51, and the reason the trucks came to life was never actually given. Oh, and after a look at Chekhov's motorcycle being lovingly tended to by Logan until its owner returns to claim it, supposedly there was going to be a subplot where Logan and the motorcycle fell in love with one another after the machines became sentient, according to IMDb's trivia page, but I am going to need a whole lot more verification of that before I actually believe it, because it sounds like straight-up weapons-grade balonium to me. So yeah. To be blunt, there's actually a lot more to wade through until we get to something really happening. But the movie proper does kick off when Hope and the others find Phil's truck again on the way back, now fully out in the middle of the road and blocking traffic. They pull over and push it out of the way in a scene that maybe isn't quite as tense as it should be due to the way it's staged. They don't make anything of the idea that it could come to life and kill them at any second, which feels like a wasted opportunity. But as they're putting their backs into it, the refrigerated truck comes to life and starts barreling down the highway in their direction, accompanied by a score that's pretty obviously intended to evoke the ba-dum-bum-ba-bum theme of 1984's The Terminator. Jack narrowly avoids being hit by the 18-wheeler, and the Lunar Express is absolutely fucking wrecked by it. But Hope manages to retrieve her late 90s cell phone from the vehicle before it's destroyed, so if you want to look at obsolete communications tech from 1997, this is your film. And she calls Logan and asks him to send Ray to pick the group up from Phil's junkyard. Ray's just finished settling bickering couple Brad and June into their cabin, as well as delivering some more expository dialogue to his son about keeping him safe that feels extra clunky because they're talking to each other about things they both already know, and he immediately gets in his station wagon and gets going. And I know it's hypocritical of me after all the complaining I just did about too much exposition, but I absolutely do not get what the deal is between Brad and June Yeager. They feel like they stepped out of another genre entirely, alternately arguing and screwing like characters from a Tennessee Williams play or a late period ripoff of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And they feel like they should have some big and tragic backstory involving some failure on Brad's part that June has never been able to forgive him for that we find out about in the third act. But spoilers, both of them die before that can happen, so they just come off as pointlessly argumentative and hostile in a way that never really feeds properly into the story. But to get back to Ray, he narrowly avoids being hit by the refrigerated truck on his way to pick up the group, which is about the closest we come to one of the big set pieces from King's original story. There, the characters begin at the truck stop, all having narrowly avoided death on the road at the hands of a series of trucks who begin ramming other vehicles at highway speeds, in scenes of carnage King vividly describes in flashback. I don't feel like any of the adaptations have really captured the terror of being out driving and suddenly seeing in your rearview mirror a massive truck slamming smaller cars clean off the road. And even though I understand this film didn't have anything like the budget to realize that, it's still kind of a bummer not to get it. We then split time between several narratives in rapid succession. Abby goes deep into sulky teenager mode, from which she will not emerge pretty much for the rest of the movie, while Jack naturally suggests meditation to her as a way of calming down after the near accident. Brad and June bicker over breakfast. And a large truck containing a shipment of toxic chemicals comes to life and deliberately sacrifices itself by ramming an electric substation to cause a massive explosion that sends plumes of lethal gas high into the air for miles around. Nobody ever actually dies of this, it's just used as an explanation of why the authorities don't show up to help out. The explosion is great, though. Don Coscarelli would be proud. With the electricity out, the cell phone signals get spotty, and the truck stop has to switch over to the backup generators for power. The refrigerator truck arrives at the truck stop, narrowly missing Brad and June as they return to their cabin for some spirited hate sex, and it begins a series of tight, angry loops through the parking lot that make it impossible for anyone to leave the truck stop or the cabins. Bob suggests shooting out its tires, but his rifle is in his truck, which is anything but safe to get to right now, and Ray doesn't keep guns on the premises for reasons we'll get into later. Ray arrives at Phil's junkyard just as Hope and the others find Phil's body, and Abby sensibly suggests getting back to Bridgeton and from there back to anywhere but here. But Ray's driving and his son is back at the truck stop, so that's where they're going, despite a harrowing sequence where a fourth truck, a yellow hook and ladder truck, headed the same way they are, begins ramming them from behind in an attempt to run them off the road. Thank goodness the television is tuned to the Exposition Channel, which alternates between static and incredibly plot-specific news updates from a TV reporter played by Barbara Lee Edwards and the local sheriff played by Don Granberry, so they can stay updated on the situation. I cannot stress enough how inadvertently hilarious it is that the signal always comes in just long enough to give the exact info dump the screenwriter needs it to, before fading back into static as though the effort has exhausted the small television set. If this was Maximum Overdrive, I'd suggest the TV was sentient and taunting them, but this sticks much closer to the original premise that it's trucks and trucks only that have come to life and developed hostile sentience. Brad and June decide to make a run for their car, but the refrigerator truck smashes it to bits. I will say that as the end boss villain of the whole movie, it doesn't have nearly as much screen presence as the weird and goofy but highly memorable Green Goblin truck from King's 1986 version. This is pretty much just a killer big rig with very few distinguishing characteristics. Even the truck in Duel had more personality. They flee back to the nearby auto garage, and it soon becomes clear that the trucks aren't going to let anyone leave. Meanwhile, a government cleanup crew called the Toxic Investigation Team, whose uniforms are all labeled with badges reading TIT, that are, I confess, the source of a certain amount of juvenile humor to this particular member of the viewing audience, head to the explosion site to find out what's going on. And in an unrelated vignette that is pound for pound every bit as dumb, if not dumber, than anything Stephen King came up with in his coke-fueled brainstorming sessions for Maximum Overdrive, a mailman who hasn't heard about the toxic gas spill is doing his rounds when one of the toy trucks in the toy store comes to life and, rams him repeatedly in the ankles until he falls over. And then runs into his head again and again until it's splattered with gore and he lies dead in the street. It is completely and totally unbelievable given the size of the truck relative to the man. It's like watching someone get beaten to death with a cardboard package tube. And it not only breaks the claustrophobic mood of isolation at the truck stop by introducing unrelated characters, but it adds a touch of campy humor that completely breaks tone with the overall rest of the movie. I cannot imagine how this didn't wind up on the cutting room floor. Ray and the group, meanwhile, arrive back at the truck stop just as Pete and Bob's trucks come to life, and they sprint clear of the station wagon just seconds before the fridge truck smashes it up. Logan has gone running out to warn them, and he and Abby wind up in the garage with Brad and June, while Hope, Ray, Thad, and Jack escape to the diner. Ray uses the whiteboard the diner writes its daily specials on to communicate with his son on the reasonable but entirely unfounded assumption that trucks can't read. I mean, sure, they can't, but they also can't drive themselves and make kamikaze runs at electrical substations, so let's not rely on this, okay? Jack speculates that a recent meteor shower might have caused an influx of magnetic particles that caused truck sentience. Because sure, why not? Bob suggests it's Area 51, and the government is planning to take over the country. And about that, I might have some news you need to hear, sir, related to events that happened in 1783. But we don't get a chance to hear more of his theories because Thad unwisely volunteers the information that he's a former military pilot, and he knows all about what happens in Area 51. That prompts a fistfight, which ends when George pulls out his dad's old .22 pistol and fires a warning shot. Ray is furious at him for packing heat and confiscates the gun for safekeeping. And proving that this movie is fully capable of topping itself when it comes to stupidity, the men from TIT arrive at the toxic chemical spill only to be killed when the oxygen pump hooked up to one of the spare hazmat suits comes to life, because I guess as part of the truck it's grandfathered into homicidal sentience, and inflates the suit, which then gets up, grabs an axe, and hacks the two-man team to pieces. Because it's full of truck air. Or something. Look, if you can't accept that a human-shaped balloon has the strength to murder two people with an axe it just happened to find lying around somewhere because trucks are coming to life, then I just don't even know what you want out of cinema, okay? In all seriousness, this may be the single dumbest thing I've ever seen on film, and I feel like it almost single-handedly makes King's adaptation look sedate and sober by comparison. I do not understand how this even made it past the script stage. Back at the truck stop, Logan and Abby bond over their respective parental issues. Ray tries to leave, only to discover that the trucks are threatening and intimidating, but not immediately murderous toward him. George explains to Hope that Ray got mad about the gun because he moved to Lunar from Detroit after his wife was killed in a drive-by, which we really could have picked up by implication, but which does make sense for her to ask about right now. Thad spots a drainage ditch with a drainage pipe and suggests that they create a distraction and get Abby and Logan into it as part of an undefined plan to get them away. Then gives us another possible hypothesis for the truck sentience by getting SETI involved in the whole thing. I don't feel like these cockamamie theories really add anything to the story, especially since we never do find out if any of them are right, and I think they would have been better off cutting every single one of them because they're not actually relevant to the story one way or another. Brad and June find a pickup in the garage, and Brad immediately makes the incredibly unwise decision of standing right in front of it to check the engine. It, of course, comes to life, crushing him between its front bumper and the closed garage door and killing him in an entirely predictable sequence, and in the ensuing chaos, Ray winds up dragging June over to the diner before she can get herself killed, seeking futile revenge against the vehicle that murdered her husband. I will say, Abby's utter sobbing freakout at the sight of her second dead body of both the day and her life feels very authentic. Amy Stewart has kind of a thankless role here, but she's really game for it. The group drags June over to one of the booths and forces tranquilizers down her throat to calm her down, while the trucks mourn the accidental death of the pickup after the fridge truck rammed it trying to kill June. It's mostly gathering around and honking. It's not as stupid as it sounds, but it's not great either. Abby decides to make a break for the diner, but Logan talks her down and reminds her that his dad is sending them messages saying, drainage ditch, not yet, and they need to stick to that quote-unquote plan. The drainage ditch comes up in Maximum Overdrive as well, and both of them are drawing inspiration from one of the most harrowing parts of the original short story. A traveling salesman does make a break for it, planning to dive into the drainage ditch where they can't pursue, but he doesn't make it and winds up being slammed a good 50 feet through the air, landing in the ditch before dying slowly and painfully over the course of the entire night while begging someone to come out and help him while they all cower inside, paralyzed with fear. It's so genuinely horrible, I'm not surprised they didn't use it. Hope and Ray bond a little over their shared decision to move out to a small town where nothing ever happens, and we find out Hope's backstory. She was in an abusive relationship in Chicago, and after getting out of it, she returned to her hometown where she felt safe. It's a more authentic-sounding expositional speech than the others, even though it's a little exasperating coming at the tail end of so much blatant and clunky info-dumping, both because it's legitimately news to Ray and because we can believe that having learned something personal and private about him, that she feels obligated to speak up in return. But before we can get his reaction, Abby decides to make a break for the drainage ditch immediately, which renders her previous scene with Logan utterly unnecessary, unfortunately, and although she and Logan both make it, the end of the pipe is sealed in by a load of gravel from Bob's truck, while the yellow truck parks at the other side and begins revving its engine to fill the enclosed space with exhaust. It's such a clear and obvious planned response that I honestly wonder if the trucks couldn't read the whiteboard after all. Ray goes running out to save them, pistol blazing, and surprisingly the trucks seem willing to let him retrieve his son and Thad's daughter. Bob and Pete decide to use the distraction to get the rifle from Bob's truck, injuring Fat in the process, but they don't have the same lenience extended to them, and Bob barely makes it over to the garage before they run him over. He doesn't die, though, which surprised me on first viewing, given that his entire character exists to be an object lesson for the others on what not to do. After what should be a tense rescue sequence that unfortunately includes the line, "My dad's got the truck spooked somehow," which I'm impressed as hell that Brendan Fletcher can even deliver with a straight face, Ray and the teens run back to the diner where Abby is reunited with her dad. Ray tells the group he doesn't know why the truck's deferred to him, saying, "I just got ticked, it seemed to work," although it should be noted that his lips do not match the sound on ticked, and it seems like someone got cold feet about even the very mild expletive pissed, which is kind of rich after showing a full-on axe murder on screen. As everything calms down and Bob discovers a fridge full of cold beers in the garage, Abby tends to the cut on her dad's head and they have an awkward conversation that I kind of like precisely because it's not a reconciliation. Fat apologizes, but that doesn't erase years of neglect, and although Abby clearly loves him, she's not ready to forgive him just because they're in a crisis. I like the maturity of that interaction. Although whoever lit Amy Stewart in this scene needs a little talking to. She's obviously playing a character younger than the actor, and the lighting of this scene emphasizes instead of conceals that. We then get a little more chatting, this time between Abby and Jack, before the group notices that June has slipped away in all the chaos. She climbs up a nearby embankment to the top of the ridge, and one of the trucks gets up there, somehow, and runs her down. It feels honestly like a little bit of a waste of a potentially good set piece because it is such a perfunctory death, but we're getting into the third act now and it really is time to start whittling down this cast a little. Hope wants to find a way to get out of there, somewhere the trucks can't reach, but Ray's in favor of hunkering down and waiting for help. Bob, meanwhile, has his own plan, taking all the beer bottles he's just emptied and filling them up with gasoline to make some Molotov cocktails. It's honestly a pretty good idea, although he might have done better if he dumped out the beer instead of drinking every last drop of it. Before he can enact his plan, though, there's finally a tiny bit of payoff to all the hippie stuff when Jack and George, the two older men of the group, reminisce about the 60s and Jack finds out that George was one of the Chicago cops he rioted against at the 1968 Democratic Convention. This was, of course, a famous clash between the authoritarian establishment and the anti-war movement that played out on live television and probably did a lot to torpedo Hubert Humphrey's chances to become president. It made it look like the Democrats had lost control of the city and by extension the nation, even though the anti-war movement was morally in the right and the police were trying to suppress them with violence. So it's definitely a nice gag that their efforts to bond dead-end into a realization that no, they are extremely different people after all. The trucks line up and try to communicate something to Ray and the others. In the original short story, their honks and flashing headlights spell out a message in Morse code, telling them they won't be harmed if they provide fuel, but even in 1973, Morse code was dying out as telephones replaced telegraphs, and it was really one of those specialized skills they only taught to Boy Scouts. By 1997, it probably would have felt kind of absurd to have someone who could translate it. Not to mention, how do the trucks learn it? They can't even read a whiteboard in this version. So there's just a lot of honking and flashing while Ray fills in the last piece of our exposition puzzle by explaining to Hope that George is an old friend of his father's who came out to Lunar with him because his liver is failing and he doesn't have a whole lot of time left. Can't imagine how that'll factor into the ending or anything. The sudden and ominous change to the truck's behavior makes Ray decide that Hope's got the right idea and they make a plan to escape under cover of darkness. Thad will take the motorcycle to the closest military base and get a helicopter, while the others slip away onto the backpacking trails Hope scouted and rendezvous with him at a safe landing spot that presumably the trucks won't be able to access. All they need now is a distraction, and hey, here's Bob ready to step out and start chucking Molotov cocktails. Unfortunately, his plan fails early and hard. Pete, seeing his friend throwing firebombs at Pete's precious truck, runs out and manages to get behind the wheel of his old vehicle. But he can't wrestle the steering wheel away from the autonomous control of the murderous, self-driving monster, and it rams Bob straight into the garage and explodes, killing both humans and the truck. Insert Tesla joke here. The surviving trucks begin to get more aggressive, knocking out the generator and the water pump, and even the smaller side garage where the motorcycle is kept, although not before Logan rescues it and smuggles it into the diner. And just before they demolish the phone booth, the payphone begins ringing and Abby makes the impulsive decision to try to answer it. This proves to be a fatal mistake, but not for her, as Jack races out and shoves her clear seconds before he's run over. She runs back to the diner to start developing that all-important survivor's guilt, and Ray finally figures it out. They want him to pump gas for them. That's why they keep letting him live, because he's the owner of the truck stop and they want to keep the man who feeds them happy. Reluctantly, he decides to go out and fuel up the trucks to buy time and create a distraction while Thad slips away in the motorcycle. Also, I know it's usually pronounced Tad, but the actor does pronounce it as Thad in this, and it throws me off every time I see it in this script. I hate, hate, hate that decision with an irrational and entirely foolish fury. Oh, also, this is another major difference from the short story. In the original, the group refuses to pump gas, only to have their shelter utterly demolished by a bulldozer that comes along to provide reinforcements. They survive, but are forced into slavery in a bleak ending that sees the human race reduced to collaborators in paving the world for their new wheeled masters. I feel like it says a lot about the commercialization of art that none of the mass media versions were willing to go that dark. Ray begins pumping gas, although his efforts to sneak them some regular instead of diesel fail. Thad drives off, and Abby decides to go along with him because her impulsive decisions in this movie have worked out great for her so far. Sorry, but this does almost rule of three the whole Abby panics and does something stupid and it puts her and others into grave danger trope the film's been developing. Inside the diner, George and Logan pack up some supplies, and Logan slips away and hides on the embankment where the slope is too steep for the trucks to reach him, then signals Ray and Hope with a flashlight to follow him. And George, totally unexpectedly, decides to sacrifice himself by shooting at the trucks to distract them further. He does a little more than distract them, in fact. He shoots out one of the headlights on Bob's old truck, and it apparently needed those to see because it goes out of control and crashes in the drainage ditch. But the fridge truck has had enough. It detaches its trailer to allow it more maneuverability and rams straight through George and into the side of the diner. Realizing it's stuck and momentarily vulnerable, Ray risks their plan to go down and retrieve Bob's rifle from his immobilized truck and shoots the fridge truck, blowing it up in a massive Coscarelli fireball that takes out the whole diner with it. That leaves just one truck left, and it can't get up the embankment after them. The three survivors, Ray, Hope, and Logan, take a break and get some rest, while we suddenly cut away to another random person gets killed by a truck vignette at exactly the wrong moment for this movie to suddenly and completely stall its remaining momentum so we can watch an electrician get mushed into a transformer by the crane truck he's using for repairs. It's a moment we don't care about, sandwiched right in between the third act climax and the final stinger, and it needed to occur much earlier in this film for it to be even slightly acceptable as a screenwriting decision. And again, none of these vignettes really work from a storytelling standpoint. They're just random deaths in a story that's otherwise very claustrophobic and tightly focused. The best thing this movie does other than these scenes is make you feel like the outside world doesn't even exist. In the morning, the trio reaches the rendezvous point and sees the helicopter flying overhead. But just as they get there, the fridge truck shows up, burned and blackened, but still perfectly functional in a scene that doesn't just strain credulity, it straight up breaks it like Bane did to Batman. The truck has perfectly pristine tires that don't look like they've been burned at all. And I spent probably 15 minutes Googling to see if this was even remotely possible before coming to the conclusion that nope, they'd ignite and they'd keep burning due to the stored energy content of all that rubber and lose their structural integrity within minutes, causing them to deflate and be useless. And while I know we saw a truck repairing itself at the beginning, this sudden invocation of extra powerful space magic with less than 5 minutes left in the movie just made me roll my eyes in frustration and annoyance, which I don't think was the emotional payoff the filmmakers were hoping for. The truck chases them as they race for the helicopter, and this unnecessary extra last-minute attempt to ladle on one or two more thrills also spoils the stinger because you can very clearly see there's no one in the cockpit as they climb on board. They lift off seconds before the truck hits them, and Logan gives Abby a tearful hug as they reunite. But she seems dazed and unresponsive, and when Ray goes up front to congratulate Thad, he discovers that there's no one flying the chopper. which is a nice enough stinger, albeit a slightly predictable one even without giving it away a couple of shots ago, but then a reassuring recorded voice says, "Hang on, folks. Just hang on." So I guess we're supposed to think the helicopter is a good guy? And it's rescuing the heroes to take them to safety? Because in this strange new world, it's heroic air vehicles versus sinister land vehicles in a kind of weird reverse Transformers origin story? That's a lot of questions I'm not sure you want raised by your very last shot of the film, and I have heard rumors that this was supposed to be a backdoor pilot for a whole TV series based on the premise, but I can't substantiate them and it's not especially important because this didn't make enough of an impression on anybody to get a sequel. The only reason it's remembered at all is for its connection to legendary author Stephen King, who has so many devoted fans that virtually any adaptation of his work is going to get some attention, and because the people who made it decided to squeeze every last penny out of their involvement both by putting it on as many streaming services as possible and by selling it cheaply in horror-themed DVD packs. Which is, naturally, how I wound up with it in the first place. And will I hang on to this movie? Not on its own, certainly, although there are still five other features in this six-film set, and one of them might make me still hold on to it. The problem with Trucks is that it's just not especially interesting. It's shot and edited relatively cleanly, and the performances don't have any standout weirdness that makes them risible, but that's almost half the problem. As coked up and bizarre and silly as Maximum Overdrive is, virtually everything about it is incredibly memorable, while this has very little that stands out against the vast sea of other killer vehicle movies out there. Comparison is the thief of joy, sure, but when you know that you could be watching Duel or Christine or The Car or even another more excitingly goofy adaptation of this same story, it's hard to imagine your hand stopping at this particular spot on your DVD shelf. So it does not count as a mark in favor of keeping the set. More's the pity. And if you want to talk about toy trucks on the hunt for vengeance, axe murdering inflatable hazmat suits, oh my god, that is the lunar connection we've been looking for this entire time, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as @halfpricehorror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, you all know I'm a big champion of indie cinema on this podcast, and it doesn't get more indie than our next film. It was made in Austin, Texas by a 12-year-old girl with the dream of making her very own movies, and thankfully, she's never given up on it. So let's talk about the debut feature for Emily Hagens, the 2006 indier-than-indie zombie flick Pathogen. See you then.